Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming. I'm Steve Ridgway. I'm president of Criterion Travel, and I want to welcome you to this last session of this year's Risk Management Professional Development Track. First things first, please mute your cell phones. I'd better mute mine, too. That would be embarrassing. Okay, the title of this session is Travel in Increasingly Turbulent Times, What's Ahead for Destinations Around the Globe. This will be an educational session. We'll have a speaker who will give a presentation for 35 to 40 minutes. We'll have a few comments from our respondent, Janet Moore, and then we'll have a few minutes for questions and answers. So please think of questions as the presentation goes along. Hopefully we'll have time to get to you after the presentation. And then before you leave, be sure and fill out the evaluation form and hand them off to Jim, our room monitor. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for this session, Joe Morozik. As you can see from his bio, Joe has impressive credentials as an intelligence officer and analyst. And currently, he's manager of intelligence products and services at Global Rescue. And in our pre-conference call, I also discovered that Joe is a newlywed. He got married just this last fall. So I have a question for you. Joe married a young woman whose only international travel had been to Canada. So where do you think they went on their honeymoon? And I should say, too, he discovered that her parents had never been out of the country. So he invited them along. Where do you think they went? Well, it turns out Joe had just completed a security assessment for a little island nation, and he had determined that the level of risk was low enough that it was a relatively safe place for Americans to go. Besides, it had some great beach resorts. So Zanzibar is where he took his new wife and her parents for their first real international experience. So that indicates to me that Joe has a pretty good level of confidence in his own ability to assess risk. So let's hear from him about how he does that, and also what he has to say about a few destinations around the globe that we might think are risky. Joe?
Thank you, Steve. All right, thank you, Steve. Just a correction to that story. I did not invite my parents to come on our honeymoon with us, but we did say we'd like to go back at some point. And I think this is it's a great story in terms of, you know, risk communication and talking to someone who hasn't really been outside the country, and you hear about Zanzibar, and you Google Zanzibar, and you kind of see some scary things, and if you've never left the country, it seems maybe even more scary. So, you know, of course, my wife at the time and fiance was searching around and sees reports of women having acid thrown on their faces, you know, years ago. It was a couple cases of that. So she sees that and gets nervous and, you know, was kind of reading about Africa and certainly very nervous. But so it was a good case study for myself in terms of how to educate someone about risk. Certainly her parents were nervous about it. But one thing I always said to them is, you know, there was an attack in Boston. Are you afraid to go to Boston? You know, there was an attack in Orlando. Would you be afraid to go to Orlando? And so it was a good process of risk communication with my wife and my in-laws. But we survived, and it was a great trip. So my talk today is called Travel in Increasingly Turbulent Times. And unfortunately, I'm kind of the bad news guy. I was here last year talking about the doom and gloom around the world, and I'm back again to give you more of the same. And hopefully one year I'll come back and say the world is perfectly safe and you can go wherever you want and there's no issues, but I don't see that coming. So a couple tasks today for me. First, I'm going to go over sort of a broad overview of how we talk about risk, how we perceive it. So it's changed on my computer, but not on the monitor. Oh, there we go. It's changing on my computer, but not on the screens here. But so I'm going to have two parts of my conversation today. First, I'm going to give an overview of risk, how we perceive it, how to assess it, where you can find information about risk, sort of a little bit academic overview of risk. And then I'm going to go into a brief assessment of about six different locations with two mystery destinations as well. So I'm going to describe a city and ask you to guess where it is, and that'll kind of be a good a lesson, I think, in risk communication. So this is a bio slide. So I am an officer in the Navy Reserve, an intelligence officer, but my views here today, of course, are my own. I've worked with Homeland Security, the U.S. Army in Iraq, private intelligence firms, and currently pursuing a PhD looking at terrorist tactics. So when I'm done studying terrorism all day for clients, I go home at night and look at, you know, terrorist propaganda videos and all sorts of lovely things. So what is risk? Obviously, there's a number of factors that we look at when we're assessing risk at a location. Obviously, we're looking at the destination, certainly the country, but even more importantly, we try to get as granular as possible when we're assessing risk. We look at the region within the country, the city or town that people are going to, even the districts within that town, and even the streets within that city. And oftentimes, as is probably the case with some of your home cities, you know, the risk can vary quite a bit from street to street. So we try to get as granular as possible with our clients and looking at their itineraries. The traveler. So we try to meet each traveler or each member sort of where they are. We have some folks that work in the nonprofit world who are going to locations that I would certainly never go to and would never recommend anyone going to. You know, Democratic Republic of the Congo, they're going to Central African Republic, some of these extreme risk locations. But that's sort of part of their job, and they enjoy doing it. So we're not going to tell them not to go to these locations. And then we have some people who, you know, cancel trips to Brussels after the attack there. And, you know, so each person has a different risk tolerance. They have different intents or objectives. If you're going to be reporting on sort of a sensitive issue in a autocratic country, you know, there's certain risks that go along with that. If you're just going for leisure travel, there's you know, different risks that go along with that. And anxiety. So again, I kind of used the case study with my wife, but I think that it's important to understand what the levels of anxiety are for the traveler, and if their anxiety is going to be more than the pleasure they'll derive from that trip, then it's probably not worth going on that trip. And we can kind of get a sense of someone's anxiety by talking to them. Types of risk. Obviously, terrorism is of critical concern to a lot of people. But as I'll mention in a moment, terrorism is really not the risk that we often talk about. I mean, there's issues like crime, civil unrest, political instability, health issues, transportation. All these things can affect travel and are more likely to affect travel than a big terrorist event. But certainly, everyone wants to talk about terrorism, but risk is certainly much more multidimensional than just talking about terrorism. And so what do we look for in a destination? Excuse me. Predictability is obviously a big topic. One reason we've been looking pretty critically at Turkey and some other destinations is because they're not predictable, and you don't know exactly when the next attack is going to happen, who it's going to target, what the government's response is going to be, and then, you know, in lower risk destinations like Western Europe, you know, you can kind of know how the police are going to respond. You know that if you call 911, the police are going to, or their equivalent, that the police are going to respond to that event. You know you're not going to have to pay them a bribe. You know that the police are not going to use live fire ammunition against protesters to break up a crowd. So predictability is an important factor. And as I mentioned, the fidelity of the government and security forces. You know, some destinations you'll need to pay bribes just to get, you know, down the street and those sorts of things. Targeting of foreigners obviously is a big thing as well. In some destinations, terrorist groups and other criminal groups will only target each other or target government security forces and not foreigners. So these are all factors we take into account. So as I've touched upon, there are really emotional and rational calculations of risk. Risk is really, at its base, a quantitative assessment. I don't get into that. I'm not a quantitative risk underwriting type of a guy, but there are ways you can quantify risk. And the way we often perceive risk is as an emotional thing. You know, when talking to my wife, we're going to Zanzibar, it was mostly emotional. As I tried to get her down to the facts and show her that, you know, there's low levels of crime or terrorist activity against Westerners, certainly, and overall, and try to get to the rational facts about the risk. And I think that's a good antidote to sort of the travel anxiety. Risk is foundationally a product of probability and impact. So, for a terrorist attack, you'd have, you know, very low probability, very high impact. And then something like, you know, petty street crime, probably a lot more probable, but certainly lower impact. So, you know, it's kind of an academic way of looking at risk, but it's important. Just kind of keep in mind notionally. And again, being your own worst enemy, picking on my wife quite a bit today, but she's not here, so that's okay. But she kind of got in her own head about, you know, Zanzibar, and it was kind of my job to get her out of her own head in that sense, and again, look at the facts. And I think it's a lot of people can do that. You start Googling things, you go down to a rabbit hole, and you're thinking about all the doom and gloom that could happen with your travel. And so I think it's our job, and it's maybe your job to try to get people out of their own heads and try to look at the situation more objectively. So this is, I think, some really important data. I showed this last year, too, and I think it came as a surprise to some people. But this is looking at U.S. citizen deaths overseas, and certainly there are other ways we could measure exposure to risk for U.S. citizens overseas. But this, I think, is a interesting metric. And the data actually has been updated. I didn't update the slide, but you can go on the State Department website and look at this data yourself. And it actually gives a breakdown of all the different locations where these events took place. So these are unnatural deaths of U.S. citizens overseas. It may come as a surprise to some people that vehicle accidents is really the leading cause of U.S. citizen deaths overseas, and that's not something I certainly worry about when I travel abroad. That was in Bangkok a few years ago, and I kind of worried a little bit more there when there's cars buzzing everywhere. But yeah, it's not something that I'm sure a lot of you have heard from your travels. I don't think anyone's really worried about traffic accidents, but it's a major cause of U.S. citizen deaths overseas. Homicides, you never know what's going on in those instances, but again, not something people typically worry about when they're traveling. Suicide, again, probably not something that people are thinking about. Terrorism and, you know, airline or flying is kind of people tend to get preoccupied with those things, but the data show that it's really insignificant risk for U.S. travelers overseas. Drowning, a lot of that actually is in the Caribbean, I think, and people doing some fun sports that ended up not going so well. But there are a bunch of other categories as well. You can get on there and look at this, but this is something we try to point out when people get all kind of fixated on terrorism. You know, again, the data just doesn't back it up. The odds are extremely slim. It's been kind of a new hobby of people who study terrorism to find other events that are more likely to happen than being affected by a terrorist attack. One of my favorites is that you're more likely to die from falling furniture in your own home than you are from terrorism. Bathtub drownings, I mean, there's all sorts of kind of random things that can more likely to affect you than terrorism. Certainly terrorism gets most of the play in the media. It's more sensational, it's on the news for quite a while, but the reality is it's an extremely low probability event. Certainly in some locations it might be a little bit higher. If you're going into some places in the Middle East, perhaps, or Africa, you know, you're exposing yourself a little bit more to that risk, but in general, it's a low probability risk. So some sources for collecting risk information, and these are sources that we use. Everything me and my team use is open source. We don't have access to some the secret information somewhere. This is all openly available information. Government websites, particularly for Western governments, is a huge source of information. We don't simply regurgitate information that we get from the State Department, but it is a great source of information. The British Foreign and Commonwealth Office arguably has a little bit more robust reports on countries. For some countries, they have maps of areas they deem to be sort of no-go areas, and that's a great resource. The Australians do a similarly good job with some good maps of areas to avoid. And also, you know, the Canadians do a great job, the French, New Zealand. A lot of these Western governments have pretty robust country reports that we use, and they update them regularly. And you can subscribe to these updates so you get them in your inbox. Embassies, just about every U.S. embassy has a regional security officer, and that's a diplomatic security agent who's assigned to that embassy, and his responsibility is essentially the safety of U.S. citizens in that country. Certainly for embassy staff, but also for U.S. citizens traveling. And most of the times, their contact information is on their embassy website, and so we'll reach out to them and try to get some information, particularly if events unfold and we want to get their assessment on the ground. But you should feel free to do that as well if you're a U.S. citizen. If you're a citizen of a different country, you can reach out to that embassy and ask for information as well. They range in terms of their response, but oftentimes you can get some good information. But certainly each embassy has a consular services office, and you should feel free to reach out and use that as a resource, at least to show that you're doing your due diligence for your travelers, too. And if you get a response back from them, you can say, hey, I contacted the embassy, and they haven't reported anything significant for this travel. And oftentimes, if you're going to someplace even more risky, you could even give them your itinerary, and that way they can know where you are at all times, in case something does happen. Travel blogs and websites we use quite a bit. TripAdvisor is really a great resource for us. Obviously, everything we're reading on TripAdvisor, you know, you kind of take with a grain of salt because you don't really know who the person is writing it. But you can kind of gauge based on their interactions with the website. You can see how many times they've posted. You can kind of gauge their credibility a little bit in terms of their assessment. But this has been a tremendous resource lately for us, looking at Ethiopia and people going to Ethiopia. There's not a lot of information coming out of Ethiopia in the press, but you go on TripAdvisor and you can read reports from people where they've gone. You know, they report feeling safe, and these anecdotal accounts really help us sort of round out the risk assessment that we provide. And certainly you can get on there and ask people questions and say, hey, I saw you went to Addis Ababa last month. What do you think about security? Did you see anyone? Did you see security agents around? How was the hotel security where you stayed? And this is a really great resource. WikiTravel as well, but other travel blogs, you should feel free to use those as a resource. We certainly do in our assessments. And then locals. Locals is kind of a good source for all intelligence, but people who are local to the area really know what's going on. They know when the next protest is going to be. They know what streets to avoid, just like in your home cities. If I'm from Boston, if someone came to Boston and said, where should I avoid, we'd be able to tell them, you know, just from local knowledge. And it's the same when you travel abroad. Always check in with your hotel staff and other trusted locals, and they'll have a better idea than really anybody about what's going on and maybe what risks exist in that city. And maybe, you know, who to trust, who not to trust. What are the local issues? Has there been a trend of, you know, targeting of Americans or foreigners in that city? They'll have all that information. So now I'm going to get into, I guess, the heart of the matter here, which is a brief overview of different destinations. And I've talked to Steve and Mara, and I've got some feedback from everyone about what destinations are perceived to be more turbulent for your travel and for your clients. Obviously, so this is a map that we have at Global Rescue. We assign a security risk rating for every country and a medical risk rating as well. And this kind of helps our clients figure out what, you know, kind of assess briefly, you know, what the security situation is in that country. But before I get into these six locations, I'm going to try something new here and do a couple mystery cities and ask you to guess what city I'm describing anywhere in the world. And I think this will be interesting to some people. This one's a little bit easy, but so this city has a very high murder rate. Over 750 murders in this city in 2016 alone, which is up 50% from the previous year. There's frequent shootings, approximately 12 people shot every day in the city, equating to 4,300 shooting victims last year. The trend has continued into 2017. It's also possibly a terrorism hub. There's been at least 20 major terrorism cases in the city or linked to the city in the past 15 years. Groups like Islamic State or ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, other groups have targeted the city or have threatened different places in this city. So doesn't sound like a very enjoyable place, but does anyone know? Okay. Chicago. Yep. And this case actually comes up quite a bit when I'm talking to folks overseas. And, you know, there was one time, again, with Ethiopia, but there was a small bomb blast at a mosque in Addis Ababa. And so I reached out to a contact there and said, you know, what's your assessment? Does this change the security situation in this country or in the city? You know, should our travelers be concerned about, you know, violence in the area? And he kind of bluntly told me, hey, you know, look at your own cities before you start talking about Addis Ababa. He said, look at what's going on in Chicago. Would you be afraid to go to Chicago? And you know, of course the answer is no. You know, I wouldn't be afraid to go to Chicago. And to locals to people going to Chicago, you don't fixate on this type of stuff. You know that, or you should know that most of the murders are occurring in certain locations on the south side of Chicago, on the west side of Chicago. And there are places you don't go in Chicago, and I think people in Chicago could probably tell you that. But again, if you look at just the data and you look at what's been going on in the city to someone who doesn't know anything about Chicago, this would sound like a pretty scary location and maybe someplace you wouldn't want to go to. So it's important to keep this in mind, I think, when you're looking at foreign cities, that just because the data says one thing doesn't mean you should be all up in arms. And often the truth is a little bit more detailed than what you read. This one might be a little bit harder, so we'll see. But this city is considered the murder capital of the country that it's in. There are more murders per capita in this city than any other city in the country. It ranks among the most murderous cities in the world when you look at per capita murder rates. It's ranked as, in one study, is ranked as the 15th most murderous city in the world after locations in Central America, Mexico, El Salvador, Venezuela, Honduras, Colombia, Brazil, so Central South America. So not in really good company here. The city also has terrorism concerns. Multiple people arrested in recent years with connections to ISIS and making terrorism threats. Any guesses on this location? I didn't really think there would be, but this is St. Louis. This is where you're sitting right now. And again, not data that you're really probably aware of. And actually last year at ETC, I was talking to the Uber driver on the way back to the airport, and he was telling me, yeah, people don't even go out at night around here, and this is why, you know, the Rams left the city, and murders are really a big issue here. But I'm sure none of you were too concerned about coming to the city. I certainly was not. But it is, according to the data, one of the most murderous cities per capita in the country, certainly in the Western Hemisphere. Okay, so first destination I'm going to look at is Jordan. I don't know how popular Jordan is as a destination for you all, but Jordan is, we assess as a moderate risk, moderate security risk, according to our own assessment. There is certainly an elevated risk of terrorism in Jordan, but Jordan has experienced actually quite a bit of stability compared to some of the other countries in the region, Syria, Iraq, and Israel. So it's actually been known as sort of a little pocket of stability in the region, but certainly has been experiencing quite a bit of elevated terrorist threat recently. This is due in large part to the fact that Jordan is a key ally of the U.S. in the fight against ISIS fighters in Syria and Iraq. Many of you may remember the gruesome video of the Jordanian pilot who was captured after he ejected from his plane and was burned alive in a cage. Really awful video. But the Islamic State has, in turn, claimed responsibility for a few attacks in Jordan in the past year. Most notably, recently in December, there was an attack in Karak in southern Jordan, which is a common popular tourist destination due to the Crusader fortresses and castles in the area. So in December, at least 14 people were killed, including a Canadian tourist in that attack. 37 others were injured. And four gunmen were killed by Jordanian security forces after a standoff at the castle. Some of the reports indicate that the terrorists actually didn't realize that there were tourists in that castle, otherwise they probably would have taken them hostage and perhaps killed them, but they weren't even aware that they were there. They had kind of blockaded themselves in part of the castle. But it raised a lot of concerns from in the tourism world about whether tourists are going to be targeted in Jordan in the future. The same cell that was responsible for that attack had been planning, reportedly, an attack on New Year's Eve. And so there's also been a number of other attacks in the country targeting Jordanian security forces, which has typically been the target of preference for ISIS fighters in Jordan. And one of the major concerns is also that Jordanian citizens who have gone to Syria and Iraq to fight along ISIS, alongside with ISIS, are returning home back to Jordan. And may be willing or may want to conduct attacks in the country. There's one estimate says that 2,500 Jordanians have gone to join the fight with Islamic State, which is certainly a sizable number. So our outlook for Jordan is that the elevated threat will remain in the country. That we had that attack in Karak, and it's not enough to develop a trend line of whether they're going to target tourists anymore. Certainly we've seen fighters or ISIS ISIS types, target tourists around the world, and so it's certainly possible that they'll target tourists in Jordan as well, in an effort to sort of destabilize the Jordanian government. So we're hoping that the attack in Karak is not a is not a sign of things to come in Jordan. Who has been to Jordan or has operations or goes to Jordan? I'm sure you guys who are more familiar with the country probably might have your ear to the ground a little bit more and know the places to go and not to go in Jordan. Egypt, another country that has been at the fore when it comes to discussions of international security risks. We have Jordan as a high security risk country. And I should have prefaced this discussion by saying that we're certainly in no way saying not to go to these countries. We have people going to these countries all the time and have great trips. And we have people going to even more quote-unquote dangerous countries. So we're not certainly saying don't go to these locations. It's just this is our assessment. And certainly by taking precautions, you can mitigate a lot of the risks in going to some of these destinations. But Egypt has experienced a number of attacks in the past year, some political instability, some civil unrest, as it has over the previous few years. There are a number of Islamist terrorist groups or militant groups operating in Egypt that have all shown they've been operational in recent years. In January last year, two assailants attacked visitors at a hotel in Hurghada with knives, and three European tourists sustained injuries. And the perpetrators were reportedly trying to kidnap Western tourists as hostages, and reports indicate that they were inspired by Islamic State. The day before that, in January last year, two gunmen on motorcycles opened fire on tourists on a tourist bus outside a hotel in Giza. No one was injured in the attack, thankfully, but it was reported that Jewish tourists may have been the target of that attack. And although infrequent attacks have also targeted places of worship in the country, most notably in December, there was a large attack at a Coptic Christian cathedral in Cairo, and about 25 people were killed, and 40 others were injured. And so religious minorities continue to be a target in Egypt. So what to expect in Egypt, it's I think we can say with pretty high confidence that Egypt is likely to experience similar small-scale attacks in Cairo, in the immediate Cairo area, the greater Cairo area, in this coming year. It's possible tourists will continue to be target of interest for groups. There's recently in the news, Egypt's been in the news because President Trump is considering putting the Muslim Brotherhood on the foreign terrorist organization list. And there's been some leaked reports from the intelligence community that assess that this could create more instability in the country and perhaps lead to more targeting of Westerners in Egypt because of the sympathy towards the Muslim Brotherhood. And if the U.S. decides to designate them as a foreign terrorist organization, there could be some backlash there. So something to keep an eye on into the year. Next, Indonesia. We rate Indonesia as a moderate risk country currently. Actually, a good friend of mine went on his honeymoon to Indonesia just before mine. And had a great time. He was in Bali, and I tried to give him the due diligence and talk to him about the different risks in the country. But he had a great time and enjoyed the beaches there. So we rate it as a moderate risk due to the threat of terrorism, but also crime and unrest. And one thing that people don't often think about is the environmental risks in some of these locations. And Indonesia has experienced a number of environmental-related risks over the past year, and certainly historically. In December, there was an earthquake that killed about 100 people in Sumatra. And looking at trend lines in Indonesia, they tend to have some issues with smog or smoke during the dry season. So maybe it's something that people don't often think about. But in terms of the terrorism threat, the threat historically had been from Jamaah Islamiyah. The Indonesian security forces have largely got rid of that group. They're pretty savvy counterterrorism organizations there. They were the ones who were affiliated with the attack in Jakarta in 2009, but since then, the group has largely dwindled. So the current terrorism threat in the country is largely from ISIS and those that are inspired by ISIS. Indonesia has had a number of their citizens travel in the Middle East to fight with ISIS, and the concern now for a lot of people studying this issue is, A, whether they travel back to Indonesia, and B, whether they want to conduct more attacks in the country. In January, Four civilians were killed and 23 injured January last year in a series of explosions and gunfire in central Jakarta, and foreign nationals were among the casualties there. ISIS claimed responsibility for that. And more recently, in December, Indonesian authorities thwarted a suicide bomb plot and killed three suspects in a raid on the outskirts of Jakarta. They were allegedly planning an attack on New Year's Eve. And the next day, the U.S. Embassy released a security message alerting U.S. citizens to the multiple arrests and disrupted plots in the country, and urged U.S. citizens to use a high degree of caution in Indonesia, particularly in public areas, shopping malls, nightclubs, bars, restaurants, and places of worship. So the outlook, more of the same. There will likely be continued counterterrorism operations in the country. The hope is that most of them are thwarted before they come to fruition, but the threat continues there. And like I say, a lot of people that study this issue are keeping an eye on Indonesia in terms of whether ISIS will pose a credible threat there in the coming years. But also, again, as I say, the potential for environmental disasters in the country remains a threat. Earthquakes, fires, and the poor air quality that results, particularly in the dry months, which are from June to October. So, Turkey. A couple more here, so I'm going to try to go speed it up a little bit. Turkey, I talked about last year, and unfortunately, Turkey has not changed for the better over this past year, and there's no trend lines currently that show that it'll improve in 2017. We rate Turkey as a high-risk, high-security-risk country. We made that change in August 2015. We moved it from moderate to high, and we're kind of early in the industry, I guess, in doing that. But we kind of saw the trend lines there, that there were multiple terrorist groups in the country that are targeting major cities like Ankara and Istanbul. Prior to that, most of the attacks had been in southeast Turkey. But when we started seeing those attacks move into Ankara and Istanbul, that's when it became more of a concern. Multiple groups, terrorist groups operating in the country. You have the PKK, the Kurdish group. An offshoot of theirs, the Kurdistan Freedom Falcons, or the TAK. And then ISIS, and you also have a Marxist group that is less active but has launched attacks in the past. So when you have these multiple groups that are all trying to destabilize or delegitimize the Turkish government, there's potential there for more attacks. And so I think that the trend is going to continue. There are almost too many attacks, unfortunately, to list from 2016. Even within this past month, two killed, or in January, two were killed, 11 injured in Izmir at a courthouse, and TAK claimed credit for that attack. New Year's Day, the big attack was 39 killed, 69 injured at a nightclub shooting in Istanbul. 15 foreigners were among the dead there. I mean, I can go on and on for all the different attacks over the year in Ankara, in Istanbul, and really it's kind of sad to see that this happened to Turkey. And we've done a number of assessments for folks traveling to Turkey. Certainly, people are still going and having good experiences, but to some people, that anxiety is sort of outweighing the potential benefits of traveling to Turkey. And then the coup in July certainly didn't help, or the attempted coup didn't help matters in the country. As a political nerd and international affairs news geek, the coup attempts are always interesting to watch, especially as we're sitting in the operations center and watching it unfold and seeing images come back of the coup attempt. That was interesting to watch, but hundreds were killed in that attempt, thousands were imprisoned. It was not a good year for Turkey, unfortunately. Ethiopia, Mara actually just was in Ethiopia and said she had a great time. So I think that the situation in Ethiopia has largely stabilized. We have it as a moderate security risk currently. 2016, we saw a lot of violent unrest in the country. I mean, you could write a whole dissertation on the underlying causes of this unrest, but most of it stemmed from ethnic and political issues that go back many years, and it all sort of bubbled to the top over this past year. The Oromia and the Amhara regions were primarily affected, and this is kind of in the center of the country. We've had people going down to the Omo Valley region, and that presents different security challenges. And we've had people up in the Tigray region, which has been largely unaffected, again, due to some ethnic reasons. But the ethnic Tigrayans have enjoyed sort of disproportionate access to political power in the central government. So the Tigray region has been largely unaffected, but in Oromia and Amhara regions, there's been a lot of ethnic-rooted political grievances that have led to massive protests and resulting violence. In October, 50 people were killed in a stampede in Bishoftu. I might be butchering that name, but that's about 24 miles southeast of the capital, of Addis Ababa. Some human rights groups say the death toll is actually a lot higher than that. And the stampede happened as security forces opened fire on anti-government protesters. So again, we're talking about stability and the fidelity of security forces. This is kind of one of the results of when security forces are taking violent measures against protesters. And a U.S. national was actually killed in resulting violence on the outskirts of Addis Ababa. There's no indications that she was targeted, particularly because she was an American or a Westerner, but it seemed like she was caught up in the unrest, unfortunately. So more than 1,000 arrests have been made as a result of that stampede. The Ethiopian government has declared a state of emergency after some of this unrest, which is still in place now. And that state of emergency actually has led to more stability in the country at the expense of civil rights and civil liberties. A lot of arrests, arbitrary arrests, cutting off of communication, social media, to try to really crack down on these protesters. And to a large extent, that's worked. And we've got a lot of anecdotal reports from folks saying that Ethiopia is now, you know, sort of back to a sense of normalcy. But we assess that the sort of underlying root cause of a lot of those issues has not been addressed by the government. There's no indications that they are interested in necessarily finding a solution to a lot of those deeply rooted issues. So though the state of emergency remains, no one really knows whether it's going to remain in place past the deadline whether they'll raise the state of emergency and return to sort of that unrest. But it's, again, kind of a sad situation in Ethiopia over the past year, and it's a country I'd certainly love to go to and hope to go to in the future. And when you talk about predictability, this is another good example. The government's never declared a state of emergency in Ethiopia, so no one really knows whether they will keep it in place or whether they actually have plans to get rid of it. Western Europe. Interestingly, we did a survey of our own members and found that Western Europe actually is ranking right up there along the Middle East and Africa in terms of concerns now for travelers. Not as intense of a concern, but people now do have concerns about traveling to Western Europe, and anecdotally have heard from a lot of people who have canceled trips to Europe as a result of the attacks there. All the countries in Western Europe we assess as a low security risk. France, Belgium, Germany, a number of other countries have experienced devastating attacks over this past year, a number of counterterrorism operations and thwarted attacks over the past year. It's clear that groups like ISIS and those that they inspire have Western Europe in their crosshairs. There's a lot of reasons why that might be, but they're attractive targets to groups that are increasingly looking to show their relevance on the world stage. Again, almost too many attacks to list, but the attack in Brussels in March put a lot of people on edge. The attack in Nice in July, the truck attack, where 84 people were killed and hundreds more injured, that ISIS claimed responsibility for. In Germany, there was an axe attack on a train in Wurzburg, the suicide bomber attack in Ansbach in Germany, which thankfully not too many people were injured in that. Attack in the Catholic Church in Normandy, where the priest was essentially beheaded by ISIS, those who claimed allegiance to ISIS. The attack in Berlin, the Christmas market attack in December, it was obviously devastating. And so the U.S. State Department put out a travel warning, their second travel warning for Europe within the past year, just ahead of the holiday season, warning of attacks targeting Christmas markets and open spaces. So unfortunately, that's an example where the State Department was actually probably right, because that attack in Berlin happened a few weeks later. So the State Department continues to warn of heightened risk of terrorist attacks across Western Europe. And that's scheduled to expire in February, but who knows whether they will continue to extend that. Though I think everyone believes that there'll be more attacks in Europe, unfortunately, in the next year. So after all that good news, A couple conclusions. Risk is a quantifiable metric. It's risk perception that I think we can help change, and that's really the emotional or subjective perception of risk. And we can do, like I say, information is the best antidote to travel anxiety, and trying to provide the statistics and information about what the risks are, what the threats are at the destination. Terrorism, unfortunately, is here to stay for the foreseeable future. We're seeing terrorist attacks in places that maybe historically have not been associated with terrorism, like Paris and Brussels and Nice. And finally, risk exists everywhere in many forms. We can never get risk down to zero, certainly not when we're traveling, but certainly not at home either. You can never get risk to zero. Even when you're leaving your house, you're exposed to risk. When you're lying in bed, you got to be careful of furniture falling on you. There's always risk wherever you go and whatever you do. So when you're traveling abroad, you can never expect to get risk down to zero. And that's important to keep in mind. And so close enough to my deadline here, but I'd like to I'll open it up to the respondent and Steve.
Thank you, Joe. Keep in mind. Well, personally, I am relieved to learn that Joe actually did not invite his wife's parents on his honeymoon. And Joe, I'm sorry I got my wires crossed on that story, and thank you for correcting me.
Sure.
Well, that was very informative, I think, and it was interesting to learn about the sources of information that Joe and his colleagues at Global Rescue used to assess risk. It was pretty sobering, I think we'll all agree, when he started talking about some of the destinations that historically have been important to us in our travel programs. Certainly I have a few questions percolating in my mind, and we'll open it up first to some of you, but initially I'd like to ask Janet Moore, who is famous in our niche for her willingness to offer trips to some destinations like these that we just heard about. And would love to hear from Janet with a few remarks about this subject. Janet? And Jim, do we have a mic? Could you bring it up for Janet, please?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Joe. That was very interesting. I wish we could have put a slide of Iran and put the statistics and put them next to St. Louis and see how safe Iran looked in comparison. I think we are in for some very turbulent times. I mean, you were able to cover a number of countries or many more that you weren't able to cover, obviously. I think the strong anti-Muslim rhetoric that we are hearing right now, sadly, is playing right into the hands of ISIS. And I think we are going to be seeing their response in places that we don't expect to see it. And I think that is going to produce a real culture of fear. People are not going to want to travel. And so we have to work really hard as a community to address that. I mean, what you've shown, Joe, in your slides very clearly is that you're much more likely to die in a car accident than in a terrorist incident, but that is not how our travelers look at it, and I don't think that's a really good argument to use because they're dealing with emotion. They don't want to travel because they're scared. They are saying to you, if I go on this trip, I might die. And they don't want to hear, well, there's more people that died in car accidents, because that's what they're feeling. And we don't want anybody to take one of our trips feeling scared. So what do we do? What can we do to address this this deep fear? It's illogical. I mean, it is illogical, but it's real. And I think, and it's interesting because Peter Shankman kind of referred to it yesterday too, and I had already thought a little bit about this question. But I think it's building within our offices and our staff a culture of trust. We want them to trust what we're saying to them. And how do we do that? We gather as much information as we possibly can. I mean, I know I'll make this quick, but here's an incident that's happened. A lone gunman gets on a train and he shoots 11 people. And it happens in a city that you have a group going to the following week. You go into your office the next morning. You get 30 calls from the 30 travelers saying, well, what are you going to do? And what do you say to them? You say, oh, we're monitoring the situation. I mean, we've all said it. We're monitoring the situation. Well, what does that mean? We're monitoring the situation. Are we listening to Fox TV? Are we making our decisions by information that we're hearing on Fox TV? Or are we really gathering information from the right sources? And there is no one single source. But we have lots of sources that we should be using. The State Department warnings, yes, we're all going to start with the State Department warnings, but let's face it, those are political. They don't necessarily reflect. There are many reasons why those State Department warnings are made or amended or not made or not amended when they should be. So I take them with a pinch of salt, and I for sure absolutely go to the British and the Australian, who have much better maps and often much better information on them. So that's number one. But that's a written piece of information. You got to speak to people at the State Department. You have really, and you know, you've got to have those names, and there are, I mean, I often feel that the State Department are maligned in ways that they shouldn't be. I have had amazing conversations with the people, the Iran desk, you know, when we were doing trips to Afghanistan, and they you know, they're going to toe the party line. They're not going to tell you that much information that's, you know, very, very different, but they'll give you a real assessment of what you should do. And I always give the example, and we will make this quick, but we had a group going to Saudi Arabia right after 9/11. The State Department put me right in touch with the public affairs officer in Riyadh, a woman. And I said, what do I do with this group? I really, you know, and it was right after 9/11, and nobody knew what was going on and who was responsible and et cetera, et cetera. And I would call her every morning because the group wanted to go. And she finally said to me, you know what? Here's my answer to you. You've seen the warning, but here's what I'm going to say to you. I'm still here, and I'm taking my kids to school, and I'm picking them up, and I'm going to restaurants, and I'm eating out. And that was it. Okay, we'll send our group. If you're able to do that, and you're working, you're in the embassy, we'll send our group to Saudi Arabia. And we did, and they had a wonderful time. So State Department people, in addition to the warnings. You know, you've got to work with your operator, your inbound, your outbound operator, because they're the people who, they've been doing it for years. They have the intelligence. They have people on the ground. Don't underestimate what they can bring to this equation. You have companies, you know, Global Rescue, Control Risk, you have companies whose job it is on a daily basis to look at what's going on. You've got to use them too. They're part of the equation. And then I always say, you know, one of our best spokespeople when we have these situations is the traveler who's just come back. You know, find a traveler who's just come back, because they are going to give you a really accurate assessment of what it was like to be in that country. So gather all that information. And then when the person asks, well, what are you going to do? And you say, you know, we're monitoring the situation because we have spoken to A, B, C, D, and E, and this is what we're feeling. And it's nuanced, but they know, you know, you speak with that confidence, and they will trust you. And then the next thing I want to say is, you know, after you've, you know, convinced them that they're not going to die, they want to know, well, if we do cancel, we do decide to cancel, are we going to get our money back? You know, and I think you have to always be fair, because we're in the business for the long term. We're not in it for this year. We're in it for the long haul. And I think that fairness is always respected and appreciated. I mean, you don't let them cancel if just, you know, it's a little whimsical thing. No, but if there's real, you know, there's a real situation and you gotta let them cancel, you gotta give them their money back. I believe very, very strongly in that. And then, I think the final point I want to make is, you know, you shouldn't see canceling a trip, and it's hard, but it should be seen as a sign of strength, I think, not a sign of weakness. When it's right to cancel a trip, you cancel the trip. And that's it, you know. Sometimes people are unhappy when you've canceled the trip. I mean, they want to go on it, and they're upset at you, but you've canceled the trip for good reasons, and it's okay to honor that, and I think one of the other things that Peter said yesterday, and I love this, was we often talk about, you know, intuition. But really, it is accumulated intelligence. And your intuition often is going to be a guiding source, too. That's the other component. Don't ignore that part when you're looking at old. So that's kind of the way to deal with the emotional response, the illogical emotional response, but the real emotional response. So
great. Thank you so much, Janet. Thank you. Voice of experience, for sure. And we appreciate it very much. Great points. Other questions? Mic in the back. Joe, come on up.
Thank you. I agree with Janet on everyone having to do their own research. Being a local St. Louisan, I wanted to quote a couple statistics because you'll probably know what I'm going to say. St. Louis is the only city in the country that is not an entity of the county. So we have 330,000 population in the city and 3.4 million in the metropolitan area. So that statistic you speak of refers just to the city. If you include the whole metropolitan area, like Chicago is part of Cook County, you're talking about St. Louis, I think, is ranked 26th. So just clarification.
Yeah, I'm certainly not trying to pick on St. Louis. The point there was just to show that, you know, there are statistics out there that you can make any city look bad. And certainly, yeah, lies, damn lies and statistics. Right. And it's the same with other cities as well. You can look at different statistics and prove just about anything you want, but I think it's important to get that the full picture of every destination you're going to.
Other questions?
I'm wondering if you can recommend any specific measures we can take on the ground, aside from avoiding certain areas, maybe taking a different, you already mentioned, looking at the streets we're traveling on. I remember years ago, for example, when I went to Jordan after a recent bombing, and it was a wonderful trip. It was Egypt and Jordan, and we had so much access to the sites without crowds. That was wonderful. You could see increased security measures. We did have, armed guards on the buses, all sites. There were armed guards at the entrance of hotels. There seemed to be increased security. And I would assume that would make one more safe. I don't know if that potentially makes one a target, but I would also, that could be, I would assume that's a deterrent, but I'm not 100% sure. But are there any measures, like specific to tourists and tourist groups and moving them, that you might recommend we consider?
Yeah, we have a security operations team at Global Rescue that's made up of all special operations veterans, and they're sort of the advice guys for our company, and my job is to provide all the information to them, and they kind of provide the advice. But I'll steal from what they say, and oftentimes it's communications, making sure you have redundant communications in place. Obviously, most people will travel with a cell phone, but what's going to happen if there is an attack or there's unrest in some place like Ethiopia and the government shuts off communication or shuts off Wi-Fi network? How are you going to connect with people? When I went to Zanzibar, I traveled with a satellite phone. There are many places you can rent a satellite phone for just a week, and it's relatively reasonable. And so having redundant communications plans in place. Before we went to Zanzibar, I wrote out a huge email to my wife's parents and to my parents and said, here's how you can contact me. My phone should work. FaceTime me, email me, text message me, call me. If that doesn't work, here's the number for the hotel, the resort. That doesn't work, I have my satellite phone, we'll go to that. We had kind of a whole stage of communication plans in place, and I think having that within a traveling group is worthwhile. One thing that our security team often does recommend as well is traveling with a hard paper map of the city that they're in that day. Have sort of a rally point with everyone that is traveling in case something does happen and cell phone communication is cut off and you can't connect with other people. Where are you guys gonna rally on a map, and how are you gonna get there? Have cash on hand in case you can't use Uber and you need to pay a taxi to get around the city. Register with the State Department. We always encourage that. The STEP program, I forget what STEP stands for, but we had a case recently where some folks in the Gambia the embassy in Gambia put out a message through STEP, and all American citizens were notified about this to go to the U.S. ambassador's house that Thursday night, didn't say for what reason. Turned out at that meeting, the ambassador said, you should get out of the country. So we had clients come to us and say, hey, the ambassador just told us to leave the country. What do we do? And there was nothing really. There was nothing on their embassy website. There was no reports about it because it was kind of done low-key for different reasons. But and then it emerged a few days later that they said to get out of the country. So having that access to the local embassy is certainly helpful, but I'd say communication plans in place, you know, to the point that you get to, maybe people think you're paranoid, but that's how we often recommend people travel, and having those measures in place.
Thank you. I'm afraid we're out of time. Hopefully, Joe, you have a few minutes.
Yep,
you can
I'll be hanging
here
around.
If you have questions come up, please be sure and fill out your evaluations. And I'd like to thank again our speaker, Joe Morozik of Global Rescue, and thank you for coming.